Every parent wants their child to make friends, to have conversations, to take turns and to share, to feel love and to give love. Humans by nature are social creatures, but when your child doesn't learn the same way as other kids, teaching social skills can be a big challenge. So what do you do? Michelle Garcia Winner specializes in the treatment of people with social learning challenges. She's the founder and CEO of Social Thinking in California, a company that helps kids and adults develop social skills and meet their social goals. She's created programs that help educators, clinicians, and other professionals, as well as parents and families. Michelle has written more than 20 books, and she travels the world to talk about social thinking. Michelle, welcome to Life on the Spectrum.
Thanks, and thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. So my question for you is, first of all, why is it important for people to learn how to socialize?
Well, if I could back up with you for just a minute and describe social, because I'm not sure we always understand the full definition of social, because our social minds not only help us to socialize, which is connecting with other individuals, whether it's to work in a group or to relate in a friendship kind of manner, but our social mind also is a great interpreter. And actually, in social thinking, we talk about teaching competencies, which is more than skills, because your brain has to attend to social information. It has to interpret kind of what you mean and what you want to say, but you have to interpret others and what they're doing in the context. Then you have to problem solve to figure out what's going on around you. And then you have to create a social response. And so that's related to being with people. You also use that same mind inside of your curriculum for your kids' curriculum. And that's really another topic. I want to just throw it out there for people to know that to understand what another person might be thinking or feeling or doing or planning is the knowledge you need when you're reading a storybook to understand what the characters are doing. And it's the knowledge you also need when you're writing a paper. So just since I'm talking to parents, just to know that the social mind is not just for making friends. And that's important because a lot of people don't understand that. And they think
Absolutely.
It comes from different compartments in the mind.
Okay. Well, let me rephrase it slightly so that we're talking about just in general, people, whether on all points of the spectrum, why is it important for people to learn how to communicate?
Well, developing social emotional relationships and sustaining them is so fundamentally not only a human experience, but a species experience that we actually feel better connected. Even if our students are having a hard time doing it, it doesn't mean that they don't want it. It's in our DNA to seek the emotionality of connecting with each other. And if a student keeps saying, I don't care, I don't care, I don't care, as they age up, at some point, they start to get really depressed and really anxious. Because just like we need food and air, we need human connection to keep us feeling like we're part of something bigger than ourselves.
Absolutely. Why is it difficult for people with autism to socialize?
So folks on the autism spectrum have some different learning abilities in addition to some biological and sensory processing. But in terms of their cognitive abilities, some of our folks have really great scientific abilities. But when it comes to the social world, their brain struggles to understand other people's perspectives, to understand that other people have goals that are different from their own, to be able to understand something as elusive and innate in its understanding as emotions. How do I feel? How do you feel? How do we create plans together? This is all part of what's called our social cognition. And I think it's hard today to refute that each of us has many different types of smarts, we call them. Some people are naturally gifted in math or reading and maybe not gifted on the playground or not gifted in socially connecting. And that's because their brains are designed. Each of us has a unique brain that delivers us different types of brain smarts. People on the autism spectrum all share a trait of having their brain be more sluggish when it comes to understanding the social dynamics and understanding how to read social cues in context, understanding the difference between friendly and friendship.
Yeah, all part of your book, Social Detective, when you're talking about social smarts. You know, sometimes people can have academic smarts, but kids on the spectrum may need to learn the social smarts because it's just not in their DNA necessarily.
Yeah, and I think it's also important, you know, when we get diagnosis, we get a diagnosis based on behavioral symptoms, but the diagnosis that parents receive does not explain to them the learning differences. And so people often think of autism spectrum, people on the autism spectrum, as having a set of behaviors that need to be fixed rather than having a learning system. I look at it as having a social learning disability when you have autism, an executive functioning disability, an organizational disability. And so to help think about how can we teach our kids to understand the social world rather than simply how to behave in the social world.
So what are some of the toughest social situations for children with autism?
So there's different types of autisms out there, and our work is specifically for kids who have solid to high level language and learning abilities. But there's kind of two big factors going on. One is understanding others, understanding that people have plans that are different from yourself, understanding that people don't understand you by you just existing. That, you know, I've worked with some clients who thought just by showing up on the playground meant I wanted to play, but no one came to play with me because they were standing back just kind of looking at their feet. And they thought that mm-hmm. because they were there, that meant I really want to play with you. But no one else reads that as being somebody who wants to play, the typical kids. And so that's right. One of the challenges is understanding kind of the perspective taking loop. What's the message you want to send others? And a lot of the messages we send are without language, just our physical presence.
Because it's in my brain that I want to play with you on the playground. It might not be in the kids over by the teeter-totter's brain because you haven't told them yet.
Sure. And another challenge is that by showing up doesn't necessarily mean you look friendly. Like friendly is something you have to show people that mm-hmm. your body just doesn't look friendly just by being there. Another challenge is anxiety. Some of our guys feel really stressed in the presence of others because they really don't quite understand what's going on. I think for us, it's been really rewarding to get email from people of all different ages on the autism spectrum who have strong language to say, oh my gosh, finally someone explained to me, you know, how this works. I had no idea.
Absolutely makes sense. I mean, it's hard enough, you know, as a neurotypical person in social situations. But if you know in your heart that you're not quite certain how to approach people, of course, that's going to raise the anxiety for kids on the spectrum as well.
Yeah. And also one other thing is when people aren't coming to you or you feel like everyone else is having fun, there's an element of sadness. And so another way is we go up towards adolescence, I explain that sadness plus sadness plus sadness can equal depression. That depression, you know, some people are born to a biochemical depression and folks with social learning challenges are kind of vulnerable for depression because they may feel like they're not being included, even though other kids may feel like the kid didn't want to be included. So there's all those factors.
Yeah. So that leads me to actually, I was going to say, ask you about teens. We've just talked about children, mm-hmm. The toughest mm-hmm. social situations for kids with the ASD. Is it any different for teens? Are there different tough social situations?
I think what gets harder for teens is one, kids get developmentally cattier. Kids are more boastful of who's in their group. And then by around third grade, fourth grade, 9, 10 years old, kids not only really love who's in their group, but then they sometimes make a big deal about negatives about who's not in their group. More verbosity or sometimes meanness about mm-hmm. Who am I with, who am I not with. But I have to say, people on the autism spectrum can also, like, they're not saints. So they have some challenges, you know, they're developmentally on point too through this. And so I think there's a tendency to think everybody on the spectrum is naive or unaware. And our guys can be pretty prickly at times. And some of our kids can even bully. So we mm-hmm. have to be aware of all of those factors because developmentally, the mind just gets more complicated. We're all born to be collaborative and cooperative in nature. But as we get a sense of ourselves, we want different things. And so by the time you're becoming a teen, depending on where you are on the spectrum, if you have more social self-awareness, you may be feeling really rejected because you're seeing people just relate more actively and dating is starting and hormones are coming in. So it's a really vulnerable age where we see kids really start to get super frustrated. And the same kid maybe 5 years ago was saying he's happy by himself, that, you know, his brain was kind of overwhelmed socially when he was younger, because one of the things we see with younger kids, this happens with some of our older kids too, but with younger kids, they're a little bit more spacey, or they're like, they're happy inside of their brain, imagining whatever kind of passion that they have that they like to think about. But as they get older, there's naturally a little bit more awareness of what's going on around them. And certainly kids higher on the spectrum have more and more awareness. And so then the vulnerabilities are not only the complexity of social dynamics as kids are hanging out in cliques and moving between friends and wanting to date or flirt. There's also the a really, really compelling anxiety and depressions that can kick in. And I think the research is really been showing that. Those of us working in the field have seen this, you know, for years. And so I think that's where we have to caretake. How do we validate a person and help them feel good about where they are and what they're learning, while also helping them acknowledge their vulnerabilities and never make it sound too easy? Like, just stop being anxious. Because sometimes people say, you don't need to be anxious, just go join a group. That kind of feedback isn't helpful, because it just makes it all sound like it's easy, and none of this is easy. When your brain makes something hard for you to learn, it's certainly stressful.
You coined the term social thinking in the mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. What is social thinking?
So I coined the term social thinking, and there's a reason why I coined that term. I started with autism in the 70s when it was autism and not an autism spectrum. And I was working with classically autistic folks with minimal language, you know, limited, depending on the person, intelligence. In the 70s, we didn't think about people with autism as having really sharp minds in certain areas or many areas. So when I got to, I did many, many years working with classically autistic folks learning behavioral strategies, and that all made sense. And it was really effective in helping our folks get a little bit better and a little bit better compared to where they were. And then I got to work in a high school where I started working with highly verbal, argumentative, kind of, you
grumpy
know,
teenagers.
Highly vulnerable, very anxious. You know, I didn't know all of this at that time. And they absolutely rejected wanting to work behaviorally. They were saying they didn't care. They didn't care about people. Leave the reward system away from them. That's stupid. And so I had to go question what I thought I knew, because I'd already been in autism for many, many years. I'd always been teaching social, but I'd never been taught what social was. We just teach behaviors. So it made me really do a deep think about how to be effective in my job. I had to rethink what social skills were. Like, what are they? Mm-hmm. Where do they come from? Why do we use them? That took me into anthropology, cultural linguistics, all different reading. And what I found, and Carol Gray was out there talking about social stories. So she kind of kicked this off.
Yes, I spoke to her last
week. Oh, awesome. Yeah. So Carol was talking about social stories, and I was really inspired because she's doing cognitively based. She's getting people to understand what's going on around them. And so from my learning, I took this back to my students who were the higher level students on the spectrum who were rejecting my work. And Asperger's syndrome had just come out at that time. And I started talking to them about thinking, and that, you know, social isn't just a behavior. It's thinking. It's understanding our thinking, others' thinking. And I was just working it all out. The students were willing to come to the table when I talked to them about thinking, where they just rejected being taught behaviors because they were high enough in their awareness to feel like, if you keep telling me how to behave, then you must think I'm an awful person. So then I started explaining to them that their brain made it harder for them to think. And so I called it social thinking. One of my goals in calling it social thinking was to stay away from big vocabulary words like social cognition. Because a lot of my brighter students could use big words, but they didn't use them well.
So if there, there's a parent at home listening, what I'd love for you to do is just give me a capsule definition of what is social thinking.
So social thinking is the ability to understand our own and others' perspectives and emotions in context, to understand what's happening around us or what's happening to the people that we're seeing on a screen and a story in the news, to understand people's intentions. And so it's a term that really, the word social cognition defines it. I just use it more casually in social thinking. But it's the ability to do a perspective-taking loop, to loop through. huh, I want to talk to this person. Do they look available? How should I approach them? What do I know about them? Even if I don't know them, oh, they're in the same line and with me in this grocery store, I could talk to them because we're in the grocery store line. Or, hey, this kid goes to school with me. I've never talked to them, but I know they're in my class. And then our mind starts figuring out how can we relate. And remarkably, our mind does this in millisecond timing. Our social mind has great files in it where we recognize people, we store information about them. And so it's just this process. And it's something we take for granted because kids typically learn it intuitively starting from birth. Your mind is kind of primed for social learning, just as our bodies are primed for learning how to roll over, creep, to crawl, to walk. And our mind is primed for social learning. And one of the concerns I have out there is that when you have kids with solid to high level language and learning abilities, I really believe we have to really feed them what they want, which is a logical way to understand super abstract information. And that's what I've endeavored to do in social thinking is help logical minds think about the abstract nature of the social world in a concrete way so they feel like they can be part of it.
It's those hidden rules that you always
talk
about.
Lately, we've been talking about teaching, how does the social world work? How do I work in the world? How do I navigate and regulate in the world to meet each of our goals? And we don't all have the same goals. You know, I think parents have to be also aware, just like if parents have multiple children and even multiple kids with autism or neurotypical, some kids want more friends than others. And so if a kid just wants to have a couple of friends, but he does that well, that's awesome. You don't have to have 8 friends.
Exactly. So how does social thinking help teach social skills?
That's a good question. So we start from, you know, the thinking to the doing. So we attend to interpret. So one of the things that I started doing years ago was asking my students a lot of questions because I needed to learn how they thought before I could teach them. And we still do that today. So here's a question I asked some boys, high school boys, years ago. I was asking them, do people think about you when you're not talking to them? And each of the kids, you know, thought about this. And then we talked in a group and the kids came back with an agreed upon response that nobody thinks about them when they're not talking. And I was like,
really?
Oh, that's fascinating. And I said, well, what if you came to school on a non-Halloween day in a costume and you were the only one wearing a costume and you weren't talking to anyone? And they go, but then everybody would think about us. And I'm like, oh, well, that's interesting. So what do you think that means? Is it that nobody thinks about you or do they notice you're there, but they just don't make a big deal out of it unless you're making a bigger thought? You know, if they have a reason, a weird thought, an uncomfortable thought, like they can't figure out why you're wearing the costume, then everyone would notice you. But maybe we all notice each other even when we're not talking. How about you go study that? So I started getting kids to just work on noticing the social world and how it worked, because so many of the kids I work with have out of control sense of humor. They have great sense of humor, but they use it way too much and they drive people nuts.
So can you give me an example?
Yeah, a kid in a class who's just cracking one joke after another, sometimes really inappropriate jokes, you know, for the context. And the teacher's getting irritated because the kid won't be quiet. And then when you find out that the kids only think they're being thought about when they're talking, you're like, oh, that's probably why you're talking so much. You didn't know that in groups, we actually mostly are silent together and that we're aware of each other. Everyone has kind of a social antenna that they're aware of each other and that they exist. You don't have to talk. And so I just started unpacking it with my students and bringing them into discussions. And then that got them thinking about how the world worked, because I also started creating vocabulary to explain it to them.
Kind of be unexpected to crack jokes while the teacher's trying to give a lecture.
Yeah, but more importantly, I mean, that's a big category word. Another thing I started doing is talking to them about, is your body in the group or is your body out of the group? Is your brain in the group or is it out of the group? Hey, there's a group plan here. Can you find the plan? All of this stuff's invisible. And, you know, we might tell kids a little bit, but we expect your brain to be like a great social detective figuring this out. So the more that we unpacked it, the more we could get kids talking about it. And when you get kids talking about it, you get thinking going, because language feeds our thinking brain, and our thinking brain feeds our language. And now we build awareness that people carry. I just want to say there's a journey between learning what's going on around you and being able to actively participate. And that's where the social response comes in. Based on what's going on, what should I do? What should I not do?
Would you think it's correct to say almost the social thinking are the tools you need to then be able to go and be social?
I think being social is all of it, but I would say your social thinking is your navigator and also your regulator. Like if you understand how that person is feeling and that they're not against you, it may help you to stay calmer. So our thinking helps us in many different ways. So I agree with you that social thinking provides a lot of tools to be able to relate in the level that you want to relate, right? So we call that your response. We have a thing called the social competency model. We have a free article on it on our website, but we teach, you know, we're doing these four main things. We teach attend, interpret, based on what you're interpreting self and others are doing in a situation. Now figure out, what should you do? So that's the problem solving. And once you're figuring that out, now you do a response. And we do practice that. You know, when we get to the response, now we're learning how to approach people. How far do you stay? How do you enter a group? How do you say hi? I think people would be shocked to see how many really bright, actually pretty typical looking folks I work with on the autism spectrum who do not know how to greet their peers.
Something you got to learn.
Yeah. And then be comfortable with, because that becomes a behavior. So now it's like, now we have logic for doing it. How do you do something that doesn't feel comfortable to you? Is, well, the motivation is to kind of meet your own goal. You want to be part of the group. People actually think it's quite acceptable if you come in and say hi. But if you stand back and stare at them and don't join the group, that's when people get uncomfortable.
What are some other strategies to help kids learn social skills? I'm talking about having conversations, reading body language, recognizing social cues. Are there some other strategies outside of social thinking?
We have so many inside of it. So we have things like there's four steps of communication that you are aware of who's around you. You bring your body into the group. You think with your eyes as to what's going on around you, and then you use language to relate. Now, how do you figure out how to relate? So then we break that down into asking questions versus adding thought.
So wouldn't that all fall under the umbrella of social thinking?
Sure, sure.
What I'm getting at is once you have learned the skills you need through social thinking, and I think it's a continual, I don't think it ever ends.
That's accurate. Right? We actually work in our clinic with people all the way into their 80s.
Right. So what I'm asking is, once you've got the tools you need through social thinking to carry you, what are some other things that people can do to learn social skills? Do they go to groups, after school activities?
I think it's more about, once you're learning these strategies, what are different contexts in which you could practice or use or make sense of them?
Exactly.
Yeah, so we can absolutely, it is nice to have some kind of group engagement. And if kids have passions, passion-oriented groups are a great way to start with younger kids. But as kids get older, not everybody wants to talk about your passion all the time. And so learning how to be part of groups that are not your passion too. And so really encouraging, when we're working with kids in middle school and high school, we're always encouraging them to look at clubs and joining and just being part of your community. So in any way, whether it's a religious community, school community, sports communities, being part of that, that's easier said than done, because some of our folks feel so exhausted by the end of the school day that social is one more really hard thing. You know, I think the typical brain finds relief and relaxation in hanging out. And for our kids, it's like going to a really hard class.
Okay.
And so it's not necessarily fun for them when they're feeling like they don't have great competencies. So it depends. Each kid is different, and I'm aware parents are listening to this from all different points of view. Some of our kids are really great with just one other kid. It's okay to not have to join a big group, but to have one other person you can share your passions with, or just even parallel play together, you know, just sit around and hang out when you look at what teenagers do together, they largely hang out. A lot of them hang out, which means they're not even strongly connected. As you've been talking about conversational skills, that's part of it. But people just hang out together and have comfort together. Today, a lot of kids are looking at apps and Instagram, Snapchat, and then they're and then what I encourage them to do is share it. Like, you're looking at it, now reach over to the other kid and show him something you're interested in just to share it. So I think we have to, you know, not always be worried about, oh, my kid can't be in a group of eight. That really freaks them out. I want my kid to be part of eight. And I'm like, you know, actually, nobody likes to be with eight people at one time. Even when you get together with eight, you break into groups of one other person, two other people. And that's where we want our kids to develop competencies first, is by being in a small cluster. When we put them into big groups, if they're not ready for it, they're just going to be so stressed out, they'll find their way back to the corner and, you know, just kind of curl up in their ball. And so I think we have to really personalize it to where the person is.
So when it comes to clubs and sports teams and after school activities, great ways for kids to reach out to others and to socialize, practice their social skills, communicate. What about kids on the spectrum?
So that's what I was talking about. The pros and cons with that, I think it's totally individual on the person. You know, I just got a 3-page letter from a mom yesterday about the journey her kid with autism has been through all these years. And the last 2 years of high school, he was finally able to get himself into a lane of having people that were truly friends, not friends that the parents had kind of sculpted for them, but true friends. So I think each person has their own journey that they're on, just like any person out there. And I think being able to be part of a community is fantastic and makes you feel included, large or small. I think the most important thing to do is make sure our kids are doing something. I'm really concerned about kids who are online all of the time. They're refusing to come out of their room. They're assuring their parents that they're fine. They're talking to people online. Because I do have a strong sense that there's a difference, as valid and valuable as online friendships are, they're not the same as somebody in your face-to-face community being able to be there right with you.
So what I was sort of getting at, and what I meant was the pros and cons of these clubs. What are the pros and cons of signing up for a group that's tailored for peers on the spectrum versus putting our kids in regular programs?
Oh, I think it depends on the kid on the spectrum. You know, the spectrum is a huge spectrum of just autism alone, and then dovetails right into ADHD and other mental health challenges. And so I think the pros are always there. Like, I think we all get the benefit of feeling like you're part of community and just having something to do with your time that involves a success that's more than you, that you're always learning how to work in a group, which are incredibly important for job skills. The cons on it can be if we put our kids into these groups, and I do hear a number of even doctors sometimes recommending just put your kid in a club and everything will be fine. It's not that simple. So the cons come in when we're putting kids into a situation that is flooding them, that they don't have competencies for, that they feel rejected, they're getting more sad, they're getting more depressed. Mm-hmm. So it's really about knowing where your child is and encouraging them to grow. So not always being in their comfort zone completely, but not putting them in a place where they're just going to drown.
So it sounds like it depends on the kid, but if you can put them in a regular program so they can get that experience, great. But what about the social groups that are tailored specifically for peers on the spectrum?
So I'm a little bit of a lone ranger out there in the autism world, because I've been spending with my colleagues the last 20 years trying to figure out how to make sense of the different levels on the spectrum. I think when you put all people on the spectrum together, the folks who have more social self-awareness could possibly feel like this is not their community, that they have more abilities. And so there can be frustration unless you put them in the role of being a mentor. Mm-hmm. I think people who have less social self-awareness can feel really good and really included and great. I'm talking about kids who are reasonably to very smart, can be really smart in a classroom, but be socially clueless. And parents are great at talking to me about this. They'll be super honest. They'll say, my kid's totally clueless about what's going on. which often means that they stand out a little bit more and they, you know, may have more obvious forms displaying their autism and get stuck on topics. Being with kids like themselves feels really comfortable because they get to be themselves, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a real pro to being together. And I think with the kids who have social self-awareness, if you can group them with other folks who are like them, that feels good to them too, because it feels great for them to know that they're not all by themselves. And there's somebody else that if they mess up together socially, we can laugh about it, because it's just, we got to have humor. Mm-hmm. And we're not laughing at each other. We're just kind of like, gosh, you know, when things are hard, it's better to laugh than cry. And so many parents have told me that over the years. So I think there is a definite pro, but there could absolutely be a con. And to me, the con is when you put the entire autism spectrum together in a group, expecting everyone to function. That's just, to me, makes no sense. I worry about us not appreciating enough about the different individual persons on the spectrum and what different people need to help them.
Yeah. And I think when I was talking about the social groups, I was talking more so about higher functioning kids on the spectrum that can go into the social groups and practice their skills.
You know, it's tricky because the term high functioning can be anybody who has languages called high functioning. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I start talking about kids with social self-awareness, which means they're aware that people have awareness of them versus other people who are considered high functioning. And so that's what I'm talking about, is that's a very tricky name to say high functioning, because a lot of kids or young adults or teenagers who have awareness, if they're put with someone who's not really aware of how they're being interpreted, that can be a mismatch.
Okay.
We have a free article on that on our website, and it's called The Social Communication Profile. And we have 5 different levels of social functioning.
Okay.
Not just for the autism spectrum, because where the spectrum ends and the rest of the world begins is a very complicated, undecided place.
So what can parents do at home to best smooth the way for their kids' social lives?
I think one is understand that they have a learning disability in social, and they're not just being lazy, or that if you just keep telling them to do it over and over again, may not help them to do it. I just had a parent talking to me about, boy, I was that parent. I just kept saying, you have to do it. Just go do it. You know, yeah, just go make a friend. So then I would begin with help kids understand the social world. Just start explaining out loud what's happening. Talk explicitly about what's happening around them. We're going to go into this grocery store. Everyone has a plan to buy things. Everyone's moving in different directions. Can you spot the plan? Can you start to notice who's grabbing what off the shelf? And turn your kids into social detectives, because you cannot respond to a world that you cannot understand. And the first way to understand things is with our eyes, to start making sense of things outside of our own thoughts. One of the challenges of people on the autism spectrum is they have a brain that keeps them very tied inside their mind to their own thinking. And when they get out or they get a little overwhelmed, they just go inside their mind rather than notice what's going on around. So that's just the beginning. And then as kids are relating, really, it's okay for them. If you look at the stages of kind of development, kids share imaginations together, being flexible. We really encourage a lot of flexibility and decision making and choice making. And people may say, well, that's not social. And it's like, well, actually, it's building all the tools towards being social. Mm-hmm. So helping kids to just constantly have to choose some different things rather than just getting stuck. You know, we have a character in our community that we created called Rock Brain.
Yes.
Stephanie Madrigal created. And Rock Brain gets you get stuck on your own thinking.
Yes.
When you're stuck on your own thinking, it's very hard to learn how to think about others. And so what we're about is helping folks learn to build the tools to be able to understand beyond yourself and then also be aware of others. And so anything you can be doing to encourage that. But I think what I'm also trying to say is just having our kids immersed, like go to the playground and just play. Just I took them to a playground to play is not necessarily going to help.
You got to show them what to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And then set some little goals about, can you go take turns with that kid on the slide?
Yeah.
Can you, you know, let him go in front of you?
Preload them ahead of time before going to the playground.
Yeah.
Michelle, I want to thank you so much for your time. This has been a very interesting conversation, super helpful, lots of tips for families listening and for myself personally. And we encourage people to go to your website if they want to learn more. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time.